The Guardian.
The 4th of July, named as England's Independence Day from lockdown. But is it too soon? I'm Jonathan Friedland, columnist at The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Today, we can say that our long national hibernation is beginning to come to an end, and life is returning to our streets and to our shops.
On Saturday, July 4th, people living in England will be able to return to pubs, restaurants, hairdressers. Those places will be different, with markings showing customers how to stick to the new 1 metre plus system. Announcing the new rules on Tuesday, the Prime Minister said he was confident that the British public will exercise its common sense, as he explained that much of what had been enshrined in law will now overnight be downgraded into mere guidance, shifting responsibility to the individual and away from authorities. But is it all too soon? Many have questioned what they say is the arbitrary thinking behind the lifting of some lockdown measures, but not others. Why can you meet multiple households in a pub, but not in your own home? Why can you get your hair done, but not your nails? And how can this government, which has been plagued with U-turns and missteps throughout this pandemic, be confident their plan will work? We will discuss it all. Also, as the government prepares to wind down its job retention scheme, I'll be joined by the New Statesman's Anoush Shakalian and Miatta Farnbulla of the New Economics Foundation to ask what long-term economic measures the Chancellor should be putting in place to help an ailing labour market through the coming recession. And The Guardian's Peter Walker will update us on the curious case of the housing minister and the porn magnate and a planning decision from January. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Boris Johnson was positively beaming as he announced the further lifting of lockdown measures, which will come into effect on Saturday, July the 4th. The Labour leader, Keir Starmer, welcomed the government statement, but sounded more than the odd note of caution, insisting that the opposition will take the time to scrutinise each measure and to examine exactly how the government plans to keep the coronavirus threat level down. To discuss all that and much more besides, I'm joined on the line by The Guardian's political correspondent, Kate Proctor. Kate, great to have you back on the podcast. And I think we have both probably, not just as we talk now, only just seen Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson clash in the Commons for Prime Minister's questions. And Keir Starmer went very hard on this idea that for all your bluster, Boris Johnson, two-thirds of those who should be, as it were, captured by the track and trace, test and trace system are not being captured. How did that go down?
Yeah, I thought Keir Starmer made a good point there. He was using the government's own statistics to show that of the 33,000 or so people that have coronavirus, 10,000 have been contacted, which means in turn, you know, it's only the contacts of that group of 10,000 people that have actually been reached and asked to self-isolate. However, Boris Johnson, he got quite huffy about that. He said that Keir Starmer was being misleading with the statistics. That led to him being told off by the Speaker. You're not supposed to say that anyone's misleading in the Commons. And then after all of that, Boris Johnson comes out with this figure of 87,000 and saying that overall 87,000 people have been contacted and have been self-isolating. Therefore, we are all, you know, test and trace should be celebrated. Keir Starmer should be far more positive.
And there was this exchange, there was this moment where Boris Johnson said, well, look, nowhere in the world is there an app that can do this.
Mr. Speaker, I wonder whether the Right Honourable Gentleman can name a single country in the world that has a functional contact tracing app, because there isn't one.
Germany.
And Keir Starmer came back and said, what about Germany, where they've had millions of downloads? And he seemed to have sort of defeated him on that. Now, many, many announcements have come in the last 24 or 48 hours, but one that seized particularly political journalists was this announcement that the daily briefing that we had on Tuesday is going to be the last of those daily coronavirus press briefings. And I know people, including people who are not political journalists, who don't do this for a living, who'd almost come to sort of set their clock by the 5 p.m. briefing. Somebody I know organised to do her daily exercise and workout to the sound of the briefing and the scientific advisors and all that. I know it takes all sorts. But what do you think is behind that move? And do you think it's a wise one?
Well, it was a very sudden announcement, and the lobby, which is what I'm part of, we were given a briefing earlier on about some of the measures to expect that the Prime Minister would announce, and we weren't told anything at all about the decision to end the daily press conferences. So it was extremely sudden, and I think it's a really bad idea for them to do this at this point in time. There's been lots of criticism out there that as the economic situation worsens, and that's what we're expecting to happen in the next few months, that this daily scrutiny has gone, but the public have liked it. That's the sense I get anyway. And it sounds like from the people you speak to, it's the same for you.
It may be just the kind of people I hang around with. Maybe it was an odd sample. But I was also wondering about the psychology of it and whether or not they think it conveys the sense of crisis. If you've got a daily briefing at 5 o'clock, you'd only be doing that in a crisis. And it conveys the sense that the crisis is easing if you don't do it, which would match the easing of the lockdown. And so let's get into that. Some of the specific changes they've got in mind. They're only going to be for England. They're only going to be from the 4th of July. We should stress that. They don't start right away. They're going from the big one, the big headline changes. Instead of the 2 metre social distance, which is sort of drilled into everyone's heads, it's going to go to 1 metre plus. And the plus, they're referring to the other measures that people should take, whether it's wearing masks or washing hands, all the other things that people should do. I noticed you made a very interesting point on Twitter on Tuesday, just about something very basic, which is if you're changing from 2 metres to 1 metre, that's going to be a big hassle and a big cost for people who've put up signage, for example.
Yeah, some businesses have been really vigilant, have been trying to prepare for a long time to get things back to normal. And I know from speaking to unions, have spent an awful lot of money on getting 2 metre signage put in place and also arranging spaces to fit to this 2 metre situation. So you do have restaurant owners that have been spacing things out for 2 metres, but now found out that it needs to be 1 metre plus if they have those other mitigating things in place. So, I mean, I just, you know, the public aren't daft. The public are well able to move between different zones of 2 metres and 1 metre plus. But I just think when you've spent so much time with one very dominant message, that it is going to be difficult. And my greater fear is that it just undermines really the social distancing as a concept. It doesn't really matter what the distance is at this stage. If it is varying from location to location, on any given day, you could be in the shops, in the pub, and then in another place entirely. You are being asked to change what you do. And I just think that kind of thing is quite tricky for people.
You could imagine the sort of sodded factor where people
exactly,
just think it's,
I mean, yeah.
it's too complicated. I mean, has anyone explained to you any kind of attempt or even attempted to explain the sort of logic behind a lot of these decisions? People have been pointing up these contradictions or apparent contradictions so that, for example, if the risk is still sufficiently high that family members from, say, 3 households rather than just 2 cannot meet under one roof, then why does the government say it is okay if people from multiple households do meet under one roof if that roof belongs to a pub? Is there any explanation for why, you know, hairdressers, not nail bars? I mean, for why these inconsistencies have popped up?
Well, I guess the argument that you'll hear is that it is for economic reasons, and this is about the government trying to get as many people into a particular venue to generate cash flow. So it's going to be more beneficial for the economy, isn't it, to have a lot of people in a pub as opposed to a lot of people in a private home where nobody's making any money. So
if you charged your friends to come over, then maybe suddenly it would become safe to have them over.
Entry prices on the door for a top barbecue. But yes, that's the argument, is that trying to fill up these places is all about trying to get the economy back to normal.
Let's just talk about the fact that he has, in a way, given himself just some wiggle room, hasn't he? Because he has announced that all the legislation on coronavirus and all the restrictions, it's not like it's been completely scrapped. It just now becomes guidance. And so you do wonder if there is, you know, and people would say, God forbid, there is a second wave. But if it does come, and the government and ministers would be able to say, well, we told you to continue to do 2 metres. It was still there in the guidance. It just was no longer law.
I mean, I think he's given himself more than just a little bit of wiggle room there. I think by flipping something from legislation to just guidance puts the responsibility solely on the public. And I'm not sure that's particularly fair, to be honest, because we will see this argument, you know, if you use your common sense, if you just looked at what the guidance was, you know, this wouldn't have happened, or you could have avoided a situation if only you'd looked at the guidance. And I think the public has been instructed to follow rules for 3 months or more. And now suddenly you've just got to try and interpret it any way you want. And I think this notion of interpretation, I'm going to bring it back to the Dominic Cummings situation, but this has been a conflict throughout this whole scenario. So whether Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief advisor, interpreted the rules when he decided to travel to Durham from London for childcare reasons, whether that was fair and right is something that has come up a lot. And again, we're going to have so many more conversations, I think, about interpretation of rules, because the government has decided just to make things on an advisory level rather than on a legal level.
Obviously, if things do turn and a second wave does come, he's given himself the scope to do this, he would have to U-turn on the easing of the lockdown. And the leader in Westminster of the Scottish National Party, Ian Blackford, did mention this, that the public has been getting rather used to the government making grand announcements one moment and then having to U-turn on them a few days or weeks later. In this case, how bad would it be if the government did have to U-turn on the easing of lockdown and send us back behind closed doors, as it were? Do you sense from MPs, Tory MPs in particular, great fear around what that would mean, both for the economy and, of course, what it would mean for the country if the virus had surged again?
For lots of businesses, we've heard for quite a long time that a second lockdown would be very damaging because they've had to make so many contingency plans along the way. And this very stop-start nature of going in and out of restrictions makes it almost impossible to do any kind of long-term planning for business, which is why that's seen as such a negative thing to do for the economy. You know, I think because there's been so much discussion about whether we're coming out of the lockdown far too quickly, and some people have said, you know, are we rushing ahead with things? Is everything happening far too quickly? And then, you know, it would just really, really undermine the government's argument of their big attempt to open up the economy if only in a month's time all of this unravels.
It is striking that these proposals were only for England. You had, straight after Prime Minister's questions, Nicola Sturgeon was on her feet in Edinburgh making clear that the change in social distance measures, 2 metre to 1 metre, would not apply in Scotland. In Wales, the First Minister there, Mark Drakeford, made a joke that he's almost forgotten what Boris Johnson looked like because it's been so long since he's heard from the Prime Minister. This has been one of the stories of the pandemic, hasn't it? The sort of pulling apart of the United Kingdom and the absence of a consensus across the whole UK of how to deal with this.
I think it's very powerfully shown devolution in practice. Lots of people don't always know, you know, what exactly Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland is able to do, what can their governments actually enact. And I just think we've had a huge lesson as a country over the actual, you know, in this circumstance, the actual quite considerable power that these countries actually have. And I do think this is obviously about safety first in those very individual countries. But I can't help but think as well, a lot of this has been political, because it's all about showing that you are in control and that you can do things differently and that you will listen to the scientific advice and interpret it in the way that you think is best. So I think it's about some of these countries being able to exercise a bit of their own agency, which they're not always able to do.
Kate Proctor, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
Now, with everything that's been going on, you might be forgiven for having missed a potential scandal brewing in the Conservative Party. Robert Jenrick, Secretary of State for Housing, Communities and Local Government, has come under serious pressure in the last few weeks for a planning decision he made back at the beginning of the year. Jenrick, who was appointed to the Cabinet last year at the tender age of just 37, has come under scrutiny for the circumstances surrounding his decision, making commentators question how long Boris Johnson will stand by his minister. As we recorded this episode, Robert Jenrick pledged to release all relevant information connected to this case. The Guardian's political correspondent, Peter Walker, now brings us up to date on the facts of the story in this report.
Well, this is a planning kind of application which has been going on for quite a long time. It is an application to build a very, very big development, about 1,400 flats in the Isle of Dogs in East London, on the site of the former West Ferry newspaper print works. And it's the brainchild of a guy called Richard Desmond, who is well known for being a former media magnate. And now he's mainly a kind of property person. So whilst there is a need for, you know, more places to live in London, obviously, the local councillor had their doubts. Partly, it seems, because the amount of affordable rent flats in there was not as much as they'd liked. And so the planning permission was refused by Tower Hamlets Council and then by the government's planning inspectorate. But these incredibly big controversial planning decisions, they ultimately go to whoever the Secretary of State is at the time. And in January this year, Jenner basically overruled the planning inspectorate and the council and said that the development should take place. Quite soon after this was done, then, you know, things started to get more complicated.
The Secretary of State has admitted that giving full consent to Richard Desmond's West Ferry development was unlawful because of apparent bias. So why did he not...
The first questioning of the decision was by the local council, who launched a court case. They applied for judicial review of what he'd done. And the government basically could have fought the case, but they didn't. They basically backed down.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, let's be clear about the circumstances here. All of the parties to this application, and that includes the Mayor of London, the applicant and Tower Hamlets Council, agreed to redetermine the case at my suggestion.
And Robert Jenrick legally admitted the decision he did was wrong, and he legally admitted it was biased too, and he then legally said he would not take part in any other part of this process. But at the same time, he's insisting, and so far he's had the backing of the PM and everyone else on this, he said he didn't actually do anything wrong in the sense that it's just a kind of legal technicality, that he had to admit all of this just to kind of make sure the court case didn't run on. But Labour and other people have got their doubts.
Did the Secretary of State know when he signed the planning consent for Westbury that the next day a new levy would come into effect, which would have cost the developers tens of millions of pounds more?
The kind of biggest question hanging over this is the timing of it. Basically, Jenrick intervened to allow Richard Desmond to build this enormous block of flats a day before a local council thing called a community infrastructure levy would have come into place. And these are things that councils were allowed to charge on very, very big developments of flats and things like that, which kind of hive money off the project to be used for kind of, you know, local education projects, health projects, all that kind of community stuff. And the estimates vary, but it was thought that if the Richard Desmond development had gone ahead after the community infrastructure levy was in place, it would cost him about £40 million. And Jenner intervened the day before this was due to take place. And it came out in court that he knew the community infrastructure levy was coming in then. So as much as anything, the timing was a really, really questionable thing. And
by an astonishing coincidence, just 2 weeks after the Secretary of State took his decision, Mr. Desmond made a generous donation of £12,000 to the Conservative Party.
A conspiracy theory sceptic could say, you know, that Richard Desmond has donated to the Conservative Party in the past, which he's done. He's donated to UKIP too. And in the grand scheme of things, £12,000, you know, if you were a kind of multi-millionaire stroke billionaire, isn't a huge amount. But it's just the timing. Labour thinks that this looks really, really bad, and a lot of other people think the same way.
I'm happy to clarify that my department knew about my attendance at the event before I went to it. They knew about the fact that I had inadvertently sat next to the applicant. I didn't know who I was going to be seated by until I sat at the table.
And one of the other strange elements that came out, which emerged before even the news of the money that Desmond had given the Conservative Party, was that it transpired in November last year, so about 2 months before the decision was taken, but when the planning application was very much kind of in the works. Jenrick and Desmond sat next to each other at a Conservative Party fundraising event. And, you know, to an extent, you know, within the way that British politics is run, that's fairly normal. But the criticism is that he should have maybe said, well, look, you know, I'm potentially going to be looking at this planning application. I should sit in a different place. But Jenrick said they didn't discuss the planning application at all. However, it emerged over the weekend that Desmond says that he basically showed Jenrick 4 minutes of a kind of promotional video about this Westbury Print Works block of flats he was building. And, you know, again, you could argue being shown a promotional film isn't necessarily going to change your mind. But it's something that Jenrick didn't initially mention. This is the kind of old school political story that, you know, people like, which is a kind of scandal brewing, potential conflict of interest. And to an extent, you know, Labour have very much pushed this story along as much as they can. But to an extent, Jenrick has been slightly lucky in that there is an awful lot of other news going on, which has kind of kept it out of the spotlight a little bit. Planning decisions are not necessarily the most sexy thing in the world, but the public attention is very much gripped by the kind of one salient fact, which is he overruled other planning people to make a decision a day before something which would have saved Richard Desmond £40 million, and then the fact that Desmond gave the money to Conservatives. So it doesn't look good, and you have to at some point wonder how much longer the Conservatives want to go, you know, want this to kind of carry on for. You know, as they did with Dominic Cummings, they're sticking by him. But Robert Jenrick is by no means as vital to the Boris Johnson project as Dominic Cummings is. And my guess is he would only take another two or three embarrassing facts to come out before his position becomes incredibly difficult.
Peter Walker. I should mention that in response to Richard Desmond's suggestion that Jenrick watched a promotional video of the flats he wanted to build, a spokesman for Jenrick said, "Mr. Jenrick and the applicants were put on the same table for the dinner, although Mr. Jenrick was not aware of this prior to arriving at the venue. The planning application was raised, but Mr. Jenrick said it would not be appropriate to discuss the matter or for him to pass comment on it." A spokesman for Number 10 declined to say whether the Prime Minister knew that Robert Jenrick had viewed a promotional video. After the break, I'll be looking at how the Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, should be preparing for the moment the furlough scheme ends, and hear why his plans should take a hard look at mistakes made by previous governments. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Now, the Prime Minister's announcement that pubs, hairdressers, cinemas and other places can reopen in England from the 4th of July is the strongest sign yet that we're about to reopen what is a heavily damaged economy. July will be the last month the government maintains in full its commitment to its job retention scheme. Come August, employers will be expected to make up some of the money that has until now seen employees who've been furloughed through the pandemic receive at least 80% of their salary. The plan is that in October, the government will wind down the scheme completely. But what happens after that? It's clear that businesses will struggle long past October. Unemployment's expected to rise, despite the efforts of the Chancellor Rishi Sunak. So how should he go about planning for one of the toughest recessions the UK will ever experience? One option is to reduce the standard rate of VAT from 20 to 17.5%. That would act as a quick injection to a desperate economy that needs to see demand for goods and services boosted in the short term. But then what? To look at some of the other options on the table in front of the Chancellor, I'm joined by the Britain editor for The New Statesman, Anoush Shakalian, and Miatta Farnbulla, the chief executive of the New Economics Foundation. Anoush, Miatta, very good to have you both on. Miatta, let's start with you and also with what Rishi Sunak and the government have done so far. The Chancellor did get quite a lot of plaudits for that first wave of announcements and the degree of government support, with effectively the Treasury paying people's wages, huge percentages of the workforce, their wages. Plaudits initially. Now we've obviously got more time to get perspective. What do you think? How do you assess the job the Chancellor has done?
I think the Chancellor, to be fair, has done a pretty good job. And I think the thing that really struck me was we are in an unprecedented economic crisis. And it was very clear early on that it required unprecedented action, that kind of had to put aside ideology or manifestos and just do what was needed. And I think where the Chancellor should get credit is the fact that he saw this, put in place the job retention scheme, which was a pretty massive intervention, and has essentially propped up 9 million jobs, as well as the kind of package of support that's been put in place for businesses in different sectors. I think that the big question now is we are not through this. Even as we begin to ease the lockdown, the ramifications for the economy are going to be absolutely profound. And if you like, we're shifting from the focus being on the public health crisis, rightly so, to now the economic crisis. And it will require the government to continue putting in place unprecedented interventions. And this is not the time for the Chancellor to start shying away. This is not the time for the Chancellor to start hugging himself in ideology and the sorts of easy old prescriptions. It will require him to continue doing big, bold things if we are to weather this storm.
So given we're not through it, are you saying merely he just needs to keep on doing what he's doing and keep in place, for example, the furlough scheme, yes, to October is his promise, but maybe even beyond? Or are you saying he's going to have to do other new things we've not yet discussed, big things? Or is it simply a matter of just, yep, you did a good job when you first announced this, keep going?
So I think he's going to have to do more. I think, if you like, he's done the first set of interventions. Now, as we move forward, you know, I think for me, there are three areas where the government has to be decisive. The first is to address the gaps. So, you know, the job retention scheme and the equivalent scheme for self-employed people has provided protections. But there are about, you know, we estimate 5.6 million people that were falling through the gaps of that scheme and weren't having any protection. So I think, you know, we've been calling for a minimum income guarantee, which would essentially guarantee a level of income for all those people so that they don't fall onto hardship. And I think the government's going to have to return to something like this. But also it's going to have to think about how it eases off the furloughing scheme. Now, everyone recognises it can't be there forever. But you've got to recognise that certain sectors are going to be far worse hit by this pandemic than others. Hospitality, for one, even after we ease off a little bit. And so the government should be thinking about actually how it modifies the furlough scheme for certain sectors that are going to be particularly struggling over the course of the next year to 18 months. And then for me, the third piece is it will require huge fiscal stimulus, because demand has been sucked out of the economy. And even as the economy starts moving, we're not likely to see a return back to demand unless the government does an active job in trying to stimulate that. And that's about a big investment program, but investing in things that will generate jobs. And then a massive program of retraining in order to be able to allow people to move from industries that are struggling, going to shed jobs, into industries that are creating jobs.
And the scale of the challenge is pretty clear. I mean, I think there was a YouGov survey published just last week reported that only a third of businesses, when asked, said that they definitely would not have to make people redundant. In other words, two thirds believed they would have to, in effect, make people redundant once this job retention scheme ends. So that, as you've said, that gives us a sense of the scale. Anoush Mianta was speaking there about, she mentioned the hospitality sector, and there's been a huge focus on that. And we are starting to see the first openings there in retail and in hospitality sectors, and more to come. But that sort of, for the short term, that will obviously give a boost to the economy. How are you reading things in terms of the longer term and some of that more longer term preparation the Mianta was saying is necessary?
In terms of the longer term, I think that's going to be where, you know, the proof will be in the pudding. You know, opening a few shops that feel confident enough to open now, you know, that doesn't really tell us that much about the long-term landscape for hospitality and also retail as well, because we know that the job retention scheme is likely to end come October, or at least to be diluted significantly come October. And so I think we have to accept that there is going to be a big wave of unemployment when that happens. And that means that we have to have a stronger welfare system in place than the one that we've got. The one that we've got, you know, was very much born in the flames of austerity in 2010, with cuts and the benefit freeze baked into the reforms. We were running at, you know, this sort of strange pseudo full employment before this crisis, which was actually covering all manner of sins in terms of the modern workforce, gig economy workers, people on casual contracts. Those people haven't really been covered sufficiently by the emergency coronavirus schemes that have been put in place by the Chancellor, because there's a lack of understanding within the government of the modern workforce. And it will probably mean that the Treasury needs to release more funding to try and fill in all of the flaws of the universal credit welfare system to prepare for, you know, a genuine big wave of unemployment.
See, when you talk about that, it is quite right that the problem, however bad it looks now, it's going to look much, much worse when, in a way, the sort of masking paper of the furlough scheme is taken away and we actually look at exposed in the raw the real unemployment figure, and people are talking about return. My colleague Larry Elliott noted last week, Britain's heading back towards the unemployment rates last seen in the first half of the 1980s, really mass unemployment. Miatta, how can the government prepare for something like this if the jobs just aren't there to be had, which, given the realities of coronavirus and what we now can no longer do, those jobs just aren't there?
And look, that is a big challenge. Where are the jobs going to be? But, you know, I think Anoush is absolutely right. So the minimum the government can do is to ensure that we have a social safety net that is adequate. That's not just right for, if you like, social justice grounds, the fact that it will provide much needed protection from hardship for millions of people. But it also does the job of acting as an automatic stabiliser. So that's jargon that basically says it's a way of putting income in people's pockets that means they spend, and that's a way of helping to stimulate the economy. So it's a kind of double benefit. In addition to that, though, the government is going to have to very quickly think about job creation. And, you know, some of it might happen organically as the economy starts to rebuild and boost. But I think some of it is going to have to be stimulated by government investment.
And what kind of jobs should they be creating? Where would you be putting that stimulus money?
For me, if I were the Chancellor, two things. I would be investing in green infrastructure and services. Why? Because we know that there are jobs that could be had very quickly. People talk about energy efficiency as a classic one because it's very labour intensive and you could get it away quite quickly. But
so this is paying people to go around insulating older homes, for example.
Exactly. But you know, it also has the benefit of preparing us for, by the way, the crisis that is as imminent, which is the kind of climate crisis. But also thinking about social services, social care, the whole amount of infrastructure, public health infrastructure we're going to have to put in place in order to live with this pandemic. And so, you know, there is a job for the government in thinking about how do we invest in public services and associated infrastructure and use that as a way of creating jobs. And by the way, not, you know, poorly paid, low-value jobs in the way that we have done in the past, but jobs that are well-paid and that are, you know, reflect the sort of quality of work that people are doing. But it's not just about boosting growth. You know, something like the VAT cut might do the job of stimulating a bit of consumer demand. It doesn't do the job of how do you create jobs and how do you create well-paid jobs that begin to reconfigure the way that our labour market works.
Just one quick thing, because you've been mentioning there, I mentioned the 1980s and unemployment. When you talk about fiscal stimulus, people go back to 2008. Do you have any sense that the government is looking back, seriously looking back, studying the history of those precedents and others? Are they taking those kinds of lessons?
If you look back at 2008, the thing that we've eventually got to was kickstarting the economy. And there were a whole load of interventions that were put in place to essentially get us out of recession. But we didn't do it in a way that fundamentally made our economy stronger or better. And so we had 10 years where the economy essentially ailed after the financial crisis, 10 years in which we saw wage stagnation, 10 years in which living standards were no better than they were in 2008. For me, that is the central lesson it must learn from the last recession. Whatever you do, do not do that. Do not just kickstart the economy, but have everything underneath the surface not working, because it comes back to bite us. And, you know, the sort of pain that we're feeling now is so much worse because it comes after 10 years in which people were already squeezed, in which the economy was just not working properly.
Anoush, you were the one who put the social safety net on the agenda in our conversation. And I want to mention an interview that has appeared in The Guardian, conducted by my colleague Simon Haddonstone, with Martin Lewis, the money-saving expert. And rather usefully, he divided, or for the purposes of thinking, the workforce into four different categories. And particularly, I thought it was interesting, the bottom two that he defined, which was those at the very bottom who are in, as he put it, the financial mire. And then those who were doing fine, actually, but for whom the pandemic has been a financial catastrophe. And it's interesting the sort of difference between those groups. Those people are always, as it were, at the bottom, and then those who've been blown off course by this. Is there going to be a tension almost sort of politically for the government in dealing, or just operationally, in trying to come up with remedies or help for both those groups at the same time, because they're different, aren't they?
Yes, they are different. And particularly for a government like this one, I think that represents a unique challenge, because as Miatta was saying, for a lot of people in this country and for a growing number of people in this country before the pandemic hit, they were living in financial crisis. When you have an economy where in-work poverty is rising, where you have one in eight workers who are working but feeling like they live in poverty and can't make ends meet day to day, that is a financial crisis. That is an economy that doesn't work for far too many people. And for the government to introduce, you know, something longer term to support those people who, you know, that would be pretty much an acknowledgement that those people have been ignored for the last 10 years. And, you know, in a way, coronavirus has exposed the situation that those people have been in for this length of time by plunging a lot of other people who, as you put it, were doing fine before this into, you know, financial dire straits. And so really, if they did want to help all of those people as a collective, then they would have to bring sort of much wider reforms into the welfare system than they already have, even in preparation for the damage of coronavirus. They haven't introduced far-reaching enough reforms to it. And that, of course, would be an admission that there was something broken about our safety net in the first place.
And people like you or me or Miata would notice that. And yet, actually, I wonder if politically they could get away with it by saying this is all to do with coronavirus. And of course, it wouldn't be true, but it would say under the cover of coronavirus, we're now going to do these things that, yes, analysts like you would point out have been needed to be done for a decade, but it would at least give them a pretext for action where otherwise it might look impossible politically.
You know, they're politicians. I wouldn't blame them for putting a spin on it like that. Of course, someone like me would write up, well, you know, this is all a little bit smoke and mirrors and it was always like this. And this is why they're needing to fix this particular problem in our state. But yes, of course, they could spin it like that and they could cover it like that. Much like some people, you know, who were against leaving the European Union assume that they're going to blame some of the economic damage of Brexit on coronavirus, for example.
Exactly. Miata, the government has made very clear that it doesn't like the word austerity. Boris Johnson won't let it pass his lips. He calls it the A word instead. But eventually, these bills are going to come back. Rishi Sunak at the moment is dishing out the money, but there's going to come a moment where he has to claw it back, either through increased taxes or reduced spending. They are they not? This government are going to be unable to avoid a return to the A word and austerity eventually.
Well, so, I mean, what's quite interesting about this government is, you know, when push comes to shove, they're not naturally ideological. So I wouldn't just assume that they will opt for cuts to public spending rather than increases in taxation or some variant of the two. You know, austerity was a flawed policy when it was put in place over the last 10 years, and it will still be a flawed policy today. And what we've learned is that if you choose to kind of cut back on a combination of public spending and social infrastructure, what that does is it makes our economy weaker, and it means that it neither works for people nor does it provide the protections for people when the economy isn't working for them. So it's like a double hit. And when you then have something like a pandemic like this, you know, they'd had to chuck loads of money into health and social care and public health that were pulled back over 10 years just for us to be able to stay afloat and stay abreast of this pandemic. So it is a self-defeating policy. And I hope that lesson has been learned. And I think the big question for the government when it comes to thinking about what it does about the public finances, because it will need to think about that, is that there were always choices. The first choice is that you look to basically spend in order to stimulate your economy and then to increase revenue. And by that way, you look to kind of reduce the deficit. That's the model that the US went down. We didn't go down there. I'd argue the US were better off than we were. But also, the government has got to think about the cost of financing. And what people are talking about, the fact that, you know, our deficit is big, and it is big, and these are unprecedented numbers, no one can deny that. But the cost of financing that is at a record low. And in the end, that's the thing that matters. It's our capacity to finance the deficit and the debt that we're accruing. And at 4%, it is at a historically low level. So rather than jumping and looking at the big figure, the government needs to think about, okay, well, look, what are our routes out of this, of which taxation is one, of which spend to boost the economy and increase revenues in another, but also let's take a balanced view about the actual cost of the deficit to us today and in the next 5 to 10 years, and then make the judgment based on that.
To you both, in conclusion then, how long do you think we are going to be feeling the effects economically and politically? But let's focus. We've been talking about the economy. How long do we expect, should we expect, to feel the effects of this pandemic? Start with you, Anoush.
We are still feeling the effects of the financial crisis from 2008 now because of the way, in my opinion, the government dealt with our recovery, which was cut back on the exact services that should have made us more resilient throughout this crisis. So if they take that same step again, which it already looks like they are because they promised local government, which have been one of the biggest casualties of austerity over the past 10 years, whatever is necessary, and they appear to be reneging on that when you speak to council leaders, I think then, you know, at least another 10 years.
If the government can come up with a recovery package that is ambitious in its scope, then there is a way that we can start moving out of this. If it doesn't do that, if it meanders, or if it chooses to kind of fall on the prescriptions it's done but in the past, then this will be absolutely profound and catastrophic. So it's going to be a tough ride, but there is an absolutely critical role for the government to play in order to try to get us through this, but in a way that allows us to build back to something better than the thing that we have at the moment.
And that's all from us this week. For any listeners interested in the political landscape across the Atlantic, and who isn't, you might have seen that this week, John Bolton, Donald Trump's former national security advisor, published a frank memoir about his time in the White House. Tomorrow, I'll be speaking to Anoushka Astana about why this memoir is quite so damaging to Trump in the run-up to the November election. So do look out for that wherever you get your podcasts. And for something entirely different, we've launched a new Guardian podcast called Innermost. In it, my colleague Leah Green speaks to readers and listeners around the world about their lives in lockdown and beyond. Just search Innermost wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to all my guests this week, Kate Proctor, Peter Walker, Miatta Farnbulla, and Anoush Shakalian. The producer is Danielle Stevens. I'm Jonathan Friedland. Please do take care of yourselves. And thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.